We are in the middle of the 14th parak. Last week we had Legends and Lessons, and we were able to speak about Rav Sadja Gaon, which was a good, our once a month Yahrzeit share, which was very interesting. Hopefully people enjoyed, for those who were there. And now we're back to Mishlei.
So now that you changed the title, do we have to be more introspective or something?
What do you mean the title?
It said Mishle and...
That's always been the title. Just sometimes they don't... Yeah, that's just sometimes they don't put the whole title in.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I was quite impressed.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, that's what, you know, all the different sources that I talk about that aren't on the, you know, the typical Hebrew side. So those are usually my psychology books. And that's premeditated. I do that on purpose because that's the point, that we compare and contrast, usually finding similarities between what Shlomo Melech is saying and what modern psychology is saying. Okay. We are on Pasuk Yud Aleph. Yud Aleph 14:11. We've talked about, obviously, we have the sort of, ever since we started chapter 11, Yud Aleph, so we've been doing a lot of couplets, right? Shlomo Melech starts, the first phrase is one phrase, usually in the positive or the negative, and then the next phrase is the opposite. So here we have Pasuk Yud Aleph, Beis Rishayim Yishamed, the house of the Rasha, the house of the wicked shall be destroyed. Yishamed is an interesting word. It's passive. It will be destroyed. It's not that he's going to destroy it. It's not that somebody else is going to destroy it, but that he will have his house destroyed. The wicked one's house will be destroyed. The ohel yisharim yafriach. And the tent of the yashar. This is one of those synonyms that Shlomo Melech uses for the righteous, right? The ohel yisharim yafriach. What's that word, yafriach? The tent of the yashar, the upright person, will be yafriach, like a perach. We were just talking about my tree in my front yard, whether it was yafriach or not, and it's only partly. It will flower, or it will develop, it will improve. So number one, right, always we always recognize the parallel phrasing of Shlomo Melech. So we have, on the one hand, a rasha and a yashar, which you wouldn't necessarily put together, right? Sometimes people think that a Rasha and a Chacham go together because of the Haggadah. But Rasha and Chacham are not opposites, right? Rasha is someone who acts in wicked ways. A Chacham is someone who's knowledgeable. So it's not necessarily the case that they're opposites. They're just different. Here, however, when Shlomo Melech talks, he usually is contrasting them. So a Rasha is someone who's wicked. A Yashar is someone who's upright. It's not necessarily a tzaddik, but someone who does the right thing. But the biggest contrast that Shlomo Melech is saying here is the word bias versus the word ohel. Bias versus ohel. Steve, did you get the sheet? I also made one online. You got it also? Okay. So if we look at the Mesudas David, the Mesudas David tells us, and for those who have the new books, you can find the Mesudas David right underneath Rashi, right? So you have the top is the Psukim. I'll show it just quickly, first time. The Psukim, Rashi, Mesudas David. Always going to be the order of this book, at least. So in Mesudas David, if you look at Pasuk Yud Aleph, so he says, Bias, Rotzelomar, that's what Reish Lamed means. It means to say, Im Shehu Binyan Chazak Kederach HaBayis. Even if it's a very strong house, think of the three little pigs for a second. You know, even if it's the strongest house, if you're a Rasha, even the strongest house is going to come crumbling down, right? And this evokes, you know, maybe our familiarity with very famous people or very rich people who maybe look like they're having a very fulfilling life, but everything could come crashing down if they might make one wrong move. They might have the biggest mansion in the world, the strongest, you know, resources, but nonetheless, it all come crashing down. That's what the Besudas David is telling us. That bias rishayim yishamed, that the house, even if it's a strong house, on the flip side, what's the contrast to that, is the yashar. The yashar is the ohel yisharim yafriach. The ohel yisharim yafriach. This is weird. People can hear me, right?
Yeah.
Very strange. My internet is saying that I'm in airplane mode. I don't know what that means for a desktop computer to be in airplane mode. But it's working, so let's just not touch it. I am not on an airplane. Young Israel does not pay me well enough to have my own office on an airplane. But
you're not high, are you?
Not that way, no. So it says in Surah David that the bias is a reference to even the strongest house of a Rasha can come crashing down, as opposed to the tzaddik or the yashar in this case. Im shehu arai kiderach ha'ohel, over the page, mikol makom yafriach v'yale mala mala. Even if it's just a simple tense, and maybe you think you have very little to work with, if you're a yashar, you're an upright person, you're a righteous person, you're still going to grow, you're still going to develop, and it's still going to be fruitful, almost literally fruitful, it's going to flower. So here you have a contrast between the Rasha and the yashar. And in a simple way, we understand that it's basically just praising even someone who's in the most tenuous of circumstances can grow, and someone who's in the most substantial of circumstances can deteriorate. So that's just the contrast there. But more, perhaps more incisively, the Ibn Ezra tells us, if you look at the Ibn Ezra, that's on the opposite page on the top, right? It's those who have the book, opposite page on the top. We're going to be towards the bottom of that, towards the end of that section, because we're towards the end of the page. The Ohel Yisharim, says the Ibn Ezra. Did we talk about the Ibn Ezra yet in our Yahrzeit year? We'll have to figure out when his Yahrzeit is and talk about him. Fascinating life. Had what to do with a lot of different Rishonim from different places. But anyway, the Ibn Ezra tells us in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ol Yisharim She'enam Rotzim Be'binyane Batim. It's not just a contrast in how formidable or how great their improvements can be, but rather what it means is She'enam Rotzim Be'binyan Batim. They don't want a house. Meaning it might be that they have a real house. Maybe they have a big, beautiful, strong and fortified building that they live in. But nonetheless, that's not how they see it. She'enam rotzim bebinyanei batim kimo harishayim umoasim chemdas ha'olam. They don't live for the physical pleasures of the world. V'yoshvim ba'olim yamidim Hashem ke'etz parech. And they'll sit as, maybe even figuratively or in literally in tents, and Hashem will make them prosperous. Meaning, as opposed to how the Mitzudas David is talking about it, in terms of a person's own prosperity in the physical world, what the Ibn Ezra is saying, I think, well, it might be open to interpretation. What I think the Ibn Ezra is telling us, according to Shlomo Melech, is that the success, the yafriach, is tied to how you look at the world. If your success is defined based on your physical accomplishments, so then yishamed. If the Rasha is looking at his bias, as looking at his formidable home, his mansion, as the litmus test of his success, so then ultimately yishamed. Then it's going to come crumbling down. If, however, the yashar sees his home like an ohel, to see that there's more to life than just the house that you live in, that there's more than the physical pleasures of life, so then ultimately yafriach. That's how I understand the Ibn Ezra. That's more of a drasha and homiletical point from the Ibn Ezra. Not so psychological, but something that definitely we can think about in terms of what we prioritize in life and what means more to us, our physical pleasures or our other pursuits. Okay, let's look at Yud Beis.
I wonder whether the Ibn Ezra, who was living in Belus, also was thinking that, we shouldn't be too, make our homes too permanent here in Belus.
There is an interesting biographical note to that. I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but the Ibn Ezra was persecuted and run out of his hometown. So I don't know when he wrote this commentary to Mishle, but maybe there's something to that he recognizes the delicate balance of living in a place, and how it could always change in a moment's notice. Interesting to think about. But again, I don't know when he wrote it, but definitely something maybe he had a sensitivity towards. I find the next pasuk is very interesting, because usually, as we just mentioned, there is a contrast, the beginning of the pasuk and the end of the pasuk. This pasuk is not a contrast. It is simply, I think, a commentary of people with the wrong approach. So what does it say? Yud Beis, this is 14:12. Yesh derech yashar lifnei ish, v'acharisa darchei maves. There's so much here. there is such a thing as a straight path before a person, the acharisa, with a mapike, and its aftermath, is darche maves, is the ways of death. So what does this mean? There is a path which is good, and then afterwards is bad. So there are different ways of understanding. If you look at Rashi simply, Rashi tells us, Yesh derech yashar lifnei ish, over avera v'omer ein ba'avera. So what is Rashi telling us? Rashi's telling us, I think what Rashi means, is to focus on two words in the pasuk that seem to be superfluous. Yesh derech yashar, but then lifnei ish. Right? What's the purpose of that word, lifnei ish? Is there some kind of path which is not in front of a person? Right? Yesh derech yashar could have just been followed by v'acharisa derech darchim aves. There are paths which look straight but are really ultimately going to lead you to death. But what's lifnei ish? So Rashi tells us that it's all in the eye of the beholder. That there's an over avera who looks at a path and he's going to go down that path which is a problematic path. Acharisa darchim aves. Ultimately, it's going to be bad. But lifnei ish, in front of that person, it's a derech yashar. That person looks at that path and says, oh, this is okay. There's nothing wrong with this path. I can do this and get away with it. Or to say that it's not even that I have to get away with it. But it's something that's not even wrong in the first place. You justify what you want to do, even if really, acharisa darchim aves. And that's the word lifnei. Lifnei ish is the person who's looking at it before going into it. Right? Before he does so, he's thinking to himself, well, that's not so bad. I could get away with that. Right? That's not so bad. I'll go ahead and do it, and I can justify it in my own head. But acharisa, afterwards you'll realize that the negative consequences are coming your way. Darchim aves, afterwards you'll find that it's actually something bad. But if you look at Rashi again, he continues to say a different interpretation. Davar acher, says Rashi. This is in the third line down of those with the Mishle, with the Sefer. Yesh derech yashar lifnei ish, derech atzel yishara haisa b'enei esav shaya ish sadeh. Now, I don't understand exactly what he's trying to say by esav, but what he's saying in terms of the pasuk is that there's a kind of straight path, which is derech atzel. What's atzel? Atzel is lazy. Like atzlanut. Atzlanut is someone who's lazy. Meaning they're going the derech yashar. Oftentimes we use the word, as the pasuk right beforehand used, right? Shlomo Melech used the word yashar to mean upright or righteous. But here, says Rashi, maybe the word yashar means lazy. Sometimes to go on the right path, it requires taking some turns. It requires slowing down. It requires going around the corner. It might be a long path. It might go up and down. It might be a winding road. And sometimes that's what's required of a person. But someone who's lazy wants to take the shortcut, wants to take the easier path. That's a yashar. Straight, straight, straight. Just go straight. You don't have to deal with any ups and downs and turns. Yashar, 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 as they say in Israel. Hopefully not in this way, though. If you look, however, at the Malbim, so the Malbim takes this concept to even the next level of this concept within the second understanding of Rashi. If you look at the Malbim, so this is the Malbim. The Malbim is almost always going to be the largest commentary in the book. That's the one in here on the opposite page. We'll read it together. Yesh derech yashar lifnei ish. There is a straight path before a person. So says the Malbim, Musav al Hanal. It's going back on what we said before. Shehagam shalif pami lifamim yitav yetiv derech evil be'enav. Sometimes a person is going to look at their path and say, oh, this is okay. This is a good thing to do. But they're foolish. Mipnei shederecha evil nira betchila yashar. Because when they first look at it, it looks like it's a good thing. Neged derech hachachma. Against better judgment, against, you know, wisdom. Shebetchila so nira shehu over al hakotzim v'habarkanim. Ki tzarech lilchum neged atayvel midos hanefesh anotim leroa kamashikas of derech evel yesh beinav. B'chol zos, achris hadar chemam v'smash enkin derech hachachma t'chlas rekoz v'sof v'mishor. Says the Malbim that the way of the fool, the way of the person who is, being lazy, in Rashi's words, is to always take the easier way out, to always look at the path which is directly in front of them and immediately accessible. And says the Malbim, that's oftentimes against wisdom because, as my father used to say, if it was easy, everybody would do it. Right? Everybody likes to do the easy things. It's the hard things that set you apart. It's the difficult things that make you a better person. Right? So when says the Malbim that yesh derech yashar lifnei ish, there are some people that look at things and say, oh, yashar, this is straightforward. This is simple. I'm going to go take this path. It doesn't look like it has any thorns, kotzim. There are no thorns along this road. So I'm just going to take it. It's easier. Says the Malbim, that's neged derech hachachma. And in the end of the day, what you'll find is acharis derech emaves. In the end of the day, that's the long way around. Right, so the what's that book? There's like a Musser book called The Long Short Way or something, right? The Short Long Way, The Long Short Way. I think it's based on a Gemara or a Midrash that, wait a second. Leonard, didn't we see this Gemara in Brachos? I think towards the end of Brachos. Maybe Sam also, you maybe know. There's a Gemara at the end of Brachos that talks about, you know, someone who came and asked advice of a kid to cross a swamp or something. And then he got all dirty and all wet and something. I don't remember. Maybe I'm remembering a different midrash. I believe there's a Gemara in Brachos that talks about it. And then there was a book written about that Agadita called The Long Short Way or The Short Long Way or something like that. That's often, you know, most of the time I would say, the long way is the right way. Right? We like to take the easy way out, but oftentimes it's a band-aid or it's just prolonging the issue. It's kicking the can down the road. That's what the Malbim is saying here. But the question, however, is how do we overcome that? How do we overcome that inclination, that desire to take the easy way out? So I've talked about this before, and it actually comes up in a few of the books that we've mentioned, but I've talked about The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg, I believe. The Power of Habit, he talks about different things, different strategies of getting into good habits. And this is one that I've done myself. You know, Ricky asked me a couple months ago, you read all these books, and do you ever do anything from the books? And do this is hard to apply, and usually the books are something to think about, something to sort of to weigh, and to sort of try to apply in the best way possible. They don't always apply. But one of the examples that I brought to her was how I try to organize my life so that I can exercise. And I'm terrible at exercising. But I want to exercise. That's the first step. And the way that I do so is when I'm not exercising and I don't plan on exercising in the immediate future. So I will prepare my clothing for exercising beforehand. I'll put out my shoes. I'll put out, you know, whatever other clothing I want to wear when I'm on the treadmill or on the bike or whatever. I'll put it out already beforehand. Because what I find is that if I'm feeling a little lazy, any little thing is going to make me not want to do it, right? Any little thing, just the smallest thing. Oh, I have to go. I walk upstairs, get my sneakers, pick out a t-shirt to wear, you know, change my clothing, like all of those little steps. And it's really not, obviously, physically, it's not that much work. But mentally, and we've talked about sort of mental overload and decision overload, mentally, we have less of a desire if we have to jump through a few different steps in order to get through it, right? It's mentally exhausting to go through with that kind of activity. So what is it? What is the antidote of a derech yashar lifnei ish? That's acharisa darchem aves. How do you avoid taking the easy way out instead of the long way? Make the long way a little shorter. And this is a concept we talked about from the Heath brothers in the book called Switch. I talked about it actually a couple months ago in a drasha of mine. We should probably rename the Mishle class based on this concept, the elephant and the rider. You know, Mishle, the mushle of the elephant and the rider, because we've talked about it so many times. Probably we can't go three classes without talking about this metaphor of originally, I think it was Jonathan Haidt's metaphor in the happiness hypothesis, but it's the basis of the book for the Heath brothers called Switch. And they talk about the elephant is our animalistic or instantaneous desires, the things that we instinctively want to do. And the rider is our mind, our intellect that's trying to steer the rider, the elephant, this huge power that we all have, this emotional drive that we all have, trying to steer it in the right direction. And one of the chapters there, if you remember, is called Shortening the Path, because an elephant is lazy. An elephant doesn't want to go 500 feet that way. It would rather go 10 feet this way. And so therefore, in order to motivate our elephants, we don't tell our elephants to walk 500 feet. We tell our elephants to walk 10 feet. And then hopefully after walking 10 feet, they'll want to walk a little bit more. So that's the idea of shortening the path. One of the antidotes of taking the derech yashar, which is an acharis adarchi maves, is making the derech, which is the true derech, the right derech, making that one feel a little easier, making it feel a little shorter. And that's why, similar to my exercising strategies, which don't always work just because my schedule's too inconsistent, something that I do every single night, and this might sound strange, I put out my clothing every single night before I go to sleep about what I'm going to wear the next day. Every single night. Because I don't want, when I have to get to Daf Yomi at 6:20 in the morning, I don't want to have to be looking at 6 o'clock going through my shirts and all my ties and all my pants and all my socks and figuring out what I'm going to wear the next day. Because I've got things to do that are more important than deciding what shirt to wear. So instead, I'll do it the night before and then I'll just wake up and get dressed. It makes for a much more stress-free morning. A stress-free wake-up when I know I don't have to make any of those decisions. And maybe people have their own sort of similar strategies in that way of not having to make silly decisions that make us stressed out in the morning for no reason, getting us off on the wrong foot. So that's what I think of when I see this. Yesh derech yashar lifnei ish v'achris derech maves, that people sometimes take the easy way out, which will end up being the bad way out because they won't put the proper effort in to doing the right thing the first time round. So that's Pasuk Yud Beis. Let's go to Pasuk Yud Gimel. This is a fascinating Pasuk because it gets to what is happiness. He's not saying it explicitly, right? Shlomo Melech talks more about happiness in Koheles, right? And the Pasuk, the Gemara in Shabbos, maybe Daf Yomi guys remember this one. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about, wait a second, Shlomo Melech, contradicts himself about Simcha. Right, that simcha is either, right, what does he say? Simcha mazu asa. And then he says, simcha, there's another pasuk by simcha, I can't remember it here. I can't remember it now. But here we have another instance of where Shlomo Melech talks about simcha. Gam bischok yich avlev. Even with schok. Schok maybe we would translate as jest. Or playfulness, yich av lev, even in jest, it can yich av lev, a ke'ev lev, is a heartache, it's a pain in your heart. V'acharisa, there's that word acharisa, simcha tuga, that the joy, right, real simcha, will flip to sorrow of some kind, one kind of sorrow or another. So what does this mean? If you look at the Mitzudas David, so the Mitzudas David says, Mesudas David again underneath the Rashi. So the Mesudas David says, "Gam b'schok." This is Pasuk Yud Gimel. Afilu ba'avor riboy haschok. Im ki lo avar bezeh amitzvos Hashem mikol makom yichav libo. Thanks, Sam. Right, even if it has nothing to do with mitzvos, even if it has nothing to do with averos, you're just having a good time. You're just enjoying yourself. You haven't violated anything. You will never, nonetheless, you will have some kind of heartache, some kind of pain. When you ultimately find out that you've been wasting your time, right? Be'ez yikabal hagamul al shepana libo levatala. That you look back at your day, you look back at the year, you look back at the decade, and you say, wow, look at how much time I wasted. I didn't do anything wrong, but look how much time I wasted. right? And that, you know, we all fall into this trap, whether it's reading the newspaper or, you know, going on social media or, you know, going on YouTube. How much time we waste when we could be doing other productive things. Right, so that's what tzchok, it's not necessarily anything evil. You're not necessarily doing anything bad, but just the wasting of time is itself something you're going to regret. Right, gam b'tzchok, even with jest, playfulness, yichav lev, you're going to feel some kind of pain. Where'd the time go? What am I doing with my life? Va'acharisa, and says the Mesura Sevad, Rotzolomar, im kain, sofa tia asher asimcha tepach letuga. Maybe you started off thinking to yourself, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to watch this video. I'm going to read this article. It's going to be great. And afterwards, you realize you didn't really have simcha. You didn't have that happiness you were looking for. And nonetheless, you're going to engage with those activities, even knowing that you're just doing schok. You're not going to do anything wrong, but you're going to ultimately not be using your time productively. This does require a little bit of a preliminary, I guess you should say, valuing of your time, right? You have to value time in order to feel bad that you wasted it. If you don't value your time, so then, you know, that you're not going to feel that cave live, according to the Mesudas David. But if you look at the Malbim, so the Malbim continues to explain, what is the difference between schok and simcha? So if you look at the Malbim, gam b'schok yichav lev l'chein, hagam shetira al pnei ha'avil shesochek, even though the fool thinks he's having a good time, v'hasham etzlach aslo, and at that moment he might have this emotional feeling of joy. Nonetheless, if you continue there, this is the first wide line in the Malbim, ha'lev yichav, the heart is going to be pained, ki lev yodei amaras nafsho, your heart knows the truth. You might be having a good laugh, but deep down you know you're not having a good time. Deep down you know that you're really not so happy. This is such an insightful line from the Malbim. Halev yichav ki lev yodea maras nafsho umargish, and he knows, the lev, your heart. If you really asked a person, if you woke him up in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning and you asked him, was that a good thing to do? They know in the heart of hearts that that was a bad thing to do. It might have been an innocent thing, and maybe at the time when they were drinking, or maybe at the time where they were having a good laugh on someone else's expense, you know, they were feeling some chemicals that made them feel good for the moment. But deep down they know it's no good. Acharisa simcha tuga. What you'll notice is that your simcha, your joy, turns into sorrow. Uva acharis yodea. Shehasimcha hituga be'emes. What you thought was joy, what you thought was happiness, was really sorrow. Kielech b'derech maves, you're walking in a way of death. V'yesh hevdel bein schok u'bein simcha, there's a difference between schok, joy or playfulness, and true simcha. Haschok nira rak b'chitzon yuso, schok, joyful or playfulness, that's only on the outside. You might be laughing. The sides of your mouth might be curled upwards, but you're not actually happy. The simcha, but true simcha, that's belev. That's in her. V'yesh boche v'sochek. There are people who cry and laugh. Ki v'sochek boche belibo v'sochek b'viv. And there are some people who cry in their heart and laugh in their mouth. K'man shekasav Rabbi Akiva shabach v'sachak. That he was crying, but he was really joyful. V'yazeh amar shiyeh sochek v'libo koev. Rabbi Akiva is the one who maybe during a time of sadness has the ability to understand true happiness, or true, optimism in the case of the end of Makos. Not going to get into it now. But then there are those who are the opposite. They'll be laughing on the outside. They'll have their teeth showing with a smile, but inside they're feeling terrible. Inside they're very clinical or ultimately depressed or sad. I thought a good opportunity to bring out the Daniel Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness for this one. And I'll just read through what he says here, because it's basically the same exact idea. A couple interesting things here that you'll pick up on. If every thinker, this is on page 37, at least in my edition, if every thinker in every century has recognized that people seek emotional happiness, then how has so much confusion arisen over the meaning of the word, right? What does it mean to be happy, right? How do we define happiness? One of the problems is that many people consider the desire for happiness to be a bit like the desire for a bowel movement. That's what he says. What does that mean? It's something we all have, but not something of which we are all especially proud of. The kind of happiness they have in mind is cheap and base, a vacuous state of bovine contentment that cannot possibly be the basis of a meaningful human life. As the philosopher John Stuart Mill wrote, it is better to be a human being dissatisfied than a pig satisfied. Better to be Socrates dissatisfied than a fool satisfied. And if the fool or the pig are of different opinion, it's because they only know their own side of the question. Meaning, the pig is only happy because he wants to think or he only knows of pig things. And that's why he feels like he's happy all, because he's constantly being playful. The philosopher Robert Nozick tried to illustrate the ubiquity of this belief by describing a fictitious virtual reality machine. This I find fascinating. Daniel Gilbert wrote this book in 2006. So for those who were around in 2006, maybe you remember. But it was a very different world. We didn't have cell phones the way we have cell phones now. There were cell phones, but they were very, very limited in what they could do. And there was, you know, there were computers, obviously, but the internet was nowhere near developed as it is now. There wasn't such a thing as social media. There wasn't the access to information. Well, maybe they had a little access to information, and it already started. But the sort of the world of social media, you know, the concept of somebody being plugged in to a social environment through technology hadn't yet begun. Really, it wasn't really there. Facebook was just getting started in 2006, in the mainstream at least. So he's not talking about that, right? He's talking about a fictional reality. What does he say? So Robert Nozick tried to illustrate this ubiquity of this belief by describing a fictitious virtual reality machine that would allow anyone to have any experience they chose and that would conventionally cause them to forget that they were hooked up to the machine, right? You have some kind of, you know, virtual reality. This is like the Matrix. He concluded that no one would willingly choose to get hooked up for the rest of his life because the happiness he would experience with such a machine would not be happiness at all. Someone whose emotion is based upon egregiously unjustified and false evaluations, we will be reluctant to term happy, however he feels. It doesn't matter that in the moment he has this chemical balance in his brain that's giving him a feeling of ecstasy. We know for certain that that person's not really happy, right? That's not what happiness is. In short, emotional happiness is fine for pigs, but it is a goal unworthy of creatures as sophisticated and capable as we. So says Daniel Gilbert, there's a big difference between schok and simcha, and that's what the Malbim just explained from Shlomo HaMelech, right? Shlomo HaMelech told us, I don't know why I'm over here, but Shlomo HaMelech just told us, Gam b'schok yichalv lev, even in that sort of joyfulness, in that sort of emotional happiness, you'll know, your heart will know, at the very least, deep down you'll know that you're really being pained, right? This doesn't necessarily have to be alcoholism, but it obviously applies to alcoholism. Someone who's trying to numb their pain by drinking, and thereby, you know, trying to sort of lift their spirits in artificial ways to give them a momentary chemical balance that's going to make them feel good. But acharista simcha tuga, afterwards, what you think is simcha, what you think is true happiness, is really sorrow. And therefore, we have to be very careful about how we define our happiness and how we pursue happiness. Happiness doesn't mean a good steak dinner, but it means a healthy lifestyle. It means doing the right things and ultimately having a general feeling of happiness or satisfaction about what you've done in life. Let's move on. Pasuk Yudalid, midrachav yispa sug lev. This is a difficult phrase to translate, but I'll just read you from the Art Scroll. So 14, from the fruit of a man's mouth. Am I in the right place? No, wrong parak. One with dross. One with dross in his heart. D-R-O-S-S. What is dross? Is that like...
Junk.
Yeah, I figured it was something negative, obviously. Dross in his heart will be sated from his own ways. Midrachav yisba suglev. Someone whose heart is, you know, I guess, trashed. I don't know. I don't know how to translate it in a better way. Suglev, someone who is suglev, he will still feel satisfied by his ways. Right? This is okay. Like we said at the beginning today. That yisba, he's going to be satisfied. Umei alav ish tov. Umei alav. What does that mean? Umei alav. But above him is a good man. And mei alav means above him or elevated beyond him. Some people say that some explanations say this is referring to someone who turns away from, right? The ish tov is going to turn away from upon this type of person. A person who's satisfied with less. A person who's satisfied with his bad ways. So then the ish tov is going to turn away from them, not going to be influenced by them. However, if you look at Rabbeinu Yonah, who you don't have Rabbeinu Yonah, and it's not on the source sheet either way, either. I'll quote for you from Rabbeinu Yonah. He thinks that the word sug means something completely different. Sug is a phrase, I guess it also could mean dross. Sug is ha'ikesh v'hanishan la'olam al machshavto. Sug is someone who only depends on himself. He doesn't look towards other people for input. V'lo yakshiv l'divrei zulaso. He doesn't listen to other people. L'hisponein ha'im tovim he midvarav u'lashaklam. That he could understand from other people's criticisms whether he's doing the right thing. U'l'haniach divarav hisponeno midivrei zulaso tam soser divarav. And instead, l'haniach divarav, he puts aside any type of reconsideration, which would contradict what he's already done. Ubal hamida hazos hu sava la'olam imasav. This kind of person is continuously satisfied with everything he does, because the only things he ever does are the things that he thinks are good. And if it doesn't turn out well, that's what he was supposed to do anyway. Right? He's not going to take anybody else's criticism. And if anybody else criticizes him or her, so he'll write them off as, you know, not knowing what they're talking about. He'll write them off as not being experts. He'll write them off as not understanding his situation. Right? He'll always find a way to realize that he's the only one that knows what to do. Okay. And therefore he's going to be fine doing whatever he always does. And all the meanwhile, he doesn't find anything lacking in his own intellect or anything bad about his own understanding. He thinks he's fine. Right, this goes back to Carol Dweck's fixed mindset concept, that you don't think you have anything else to do. You don't think you need anybody else. The only thing he'll ever find to change his mind is whatever he thinks of himself. He'll never start thinking about things. This is so insightful from the Rabbeinu Yonah. That kind of person is not only the type of person who doesn't listen to other people, he's also the type of person who's not going to listen to himself. Not in terms of listening, in terms of doing what he thinks, but in terms of reconsidering. Right, a person who doesn't reconsider based on other people's input is not going to reconsider based on his own future input. He'll stick to whatever he's already doing. Right, he'll consider only what he's already established, what he's already set out to do, what he's already done in the past, and he'll continue doing this. Right, this is something that I believe Adam Grant talks about in Give and Take. He talks about the sunk cost bias. Which is that when a person already, this sort of, you know, anyone who, trying to think if I should use this analogy or not, but I'm going to do it because I already gave it away and people are itching to know what I'm thinking. A person who's already bet a lot of money on a poker hand, right? I know people are familiar with this phenomenon, right? You've got a hand, I don't know, you were dealt great cards. Great cards. People are familiar with poker. And you think this is a winning hand, but turns out that after the flop or after things get revealed, turns out somebody else probably has a better hand. But you're already in for, you know, tons of money. You already put half of your money into the pot. So what are you going to do? A reasonable person should reconsider and say, well, I could either lose more money or I could cut my losses and get out now. The only problem is you want to know what happens. You want to know the sunken cost. Maybe I'm still going to win. Maybe my hand is really actually so good. I know that my chances are only 10%, but look how much money I put in. How could I put in this money and not possibly even see the benefits? So says Rabbeinu Yonah, that's the type of person who's not listening to other people too. Because another person who doesn't listen to other people is not going to listen to his own better judgment. He's going to stay on the path he's already on. And this obviously goes way beyond poker or any other temporary game. But per person's own character traits, you're not going to reconsider who you are as a person if you're not going to let other people's criticisms or advice guide you in any way either. He's never going to think critically about his own self. He's just going to base himself on whatever comes to him first. And he's not going to think about whether or not he should think about something afterwards. This, by the way, if I remember, Adam Grant's example was about sports managers, right? Managers of teams who maybe who picked this player or that player in a draft. You know, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know. I'm trying to think who here would even know what I'm talking about. And I would guess Evan and Ron know who this person is. There was a basketball player named Kwame Brown. Does anyone remember Kwame Brown? Kwame Brown was drafted by Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan at the time was a part owner or manager of the Washington Wizards, and he had the first pick. The Wizards were terrible, so they had the first pick in the draft. They could pick any new player in the whole entire world, and they picked a guy named Kwame Brown. And ultimately what happened, I believe he talked about Kwame Brown, it might have been someone else also. Ultimately what happened was Kwame Brown was terrible. He was supposed to be the best player ever. They billed him as the best player, but he was terrible. The question is, what are you going to do now that your best pick is terrible? Are you going to try to invest more resources to make this guy even better and to justify your terrible mistake? Or are you going to cut your losses and play someone better? And you know what they did? They kept playing Kwame Brown. And 2 years, they tried playing and they tried to make him better. They said, oh, he's still developing. He's still going to get better. It never worked. I don't know how long Kwame Brown even lasted in the league. I think he went to the Lakers after that. Ultimately, he never did much. And he just, he lasted only a few years. But that's this concept. How willing are we to reconsider? And some of our own reconsidering will be based on how willing we are to consider other people's opinions. If you're willing to recognize that you yourself might be wrong, you're also willing to recognize that other people might be right. And the two things go hand in hand. It's not just that you think you're the smartest guy in the room and you're going to reconsider. If you think you're the smartest guy in the room, you're not going to reconsider. That's the point. There's a new book that just came out by Adam Grant. Speaking of Adam Grant, I believe the book is called Think Again. It's his third, I think it's his third book that he wrote by himself. He wrote another book called Option B, but not entirely his idea. But the book is Think Again. I heard him talk about it. So the second it came out, I tried to get it on audiobook, which is how I read books, as you know. And it wasn't available yet. So I looked yesterday again. It's been maybe 2 weeks now since it came out, at least from what I remember. And I looked again. And it was there. So I said, oh, I'll put it on hold. I'll try to get it. I put it on hold. I'm in the line. I am 49th in line. Wow. So while I would love to quote to you from the book, I am not reading it, and I probably won't be reading it for a long time. But that's 49th. I'll try to keep you in the loop. But that's what the book's all about. The book, Think Again, is all about reconsidering what we assume to be true and the biases that we have. and talking about our inability and therefore, you know, what should be our focus to try to be open to being wrong. But a book that I did just read that I quoted on Shabbos is a book called Quiet. Let's see, who else was in shul? Everybody here except Shiffy, Marsha, and the Kowalskis might have heard me say this. I quoted from a book, Quiet. It's a book by Susan Cain, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Won't Stop Talking. It's a fascinating book, and I wonder, I mean, she still talks about this, obviously. She wrote a sequel to the book. I'm still trying to finish this one, but she wrote this in 2012. So really in the throes of the social media, you know, developing, but not to the extent that it is now. The Power of Introverts in a World that won't Stop Talking. And she talks about how extroverts are always talking. Extroverts are the ones that want to talk. And the problem is that extroverts don't give enough attention. Not to say that extroverts aren't correct. Sometimes extroverts are correct. But oftentimes, an extrovert is not going to take other people's opinions. Because as a handyman once told me in Kansas, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. People know that phrase? The squeaky wheel gets the grease. The one who makes the most noise gets the most attention. That happens nowadays in the media world. It happens on social media. It happens with your friends. You might not notice. The one who's making the most noise, even if they're wrong, they're going to be the one that gets the attention. They're going to be the one that that always gets the solution. And this is, I think, this oftentimes with shul feedback. You know, one person doesn't like the kugel that we serve at Kiddush, and therefore everybody else has to eat a different type of kugel. Because one person gave the feedback. Well, what about everybody else? Maybe the figurative introvert, everybody else who's not complaining, actually does like the kugel. But they're just not saying anything because they're satisfied. But nonetheless, we take feedback as if that's representative of everybody else. This, by the way, is one of those tricky social media campaign tactics. You know, people politically don't like a specific political organization, and they find an advertiser that advertised with that one institution. So what happens? This whole social media uprising, they'll get 200 people to start talking about how they don't like this that they don't like this group, and that we're not going to buy your product. So what does the company do? The company is sitting there and say, well, 200 people all reached out to tell us that they don't like us advertising, so we have to pull our advertising. Why? Because all they ever hear are the 200 people. The 500 other people never even mentioned the thing. So they think the 200 is more representative. Right, this has to do with recency bias, also exposure bias, things that Daniel Kahneman talks about. But nonetheless, those are the people they're hearing from. The same thing is true just on an individual basis. If an extrovert is always the one talking, is always the one putting forth opinions, so they're oftentimes not going to hear the introvert. The introvert might be just as, if not more, astute because they're taking everything in as opposed to spewing everything out, right? So the extrovert will oftentimes neglect the opinion of the introvert. That's what we're saying here. A sug lev, however you translate that. Umeyalav ish tov. Here's another chiddush. Umeyalav ish tov. They will turn away a good person, right? The sug lev, the one who's yisba, the one who is midrachav yisba, he's satisfied with his own way. Umeyalav ish tov. From away from him will go the good person, because they're not going to even recognize them. They're not even going to give significance to the good person who's not being in line with how they're talking. That's what Rabbeinu Yonah means when he says he's not going to listen to other people. Okay, that's one, and I'll just finish off for the last pasuk tonight. Tesvav, peti ya'amin l'chol davar. We talked about this word peti. Or Pesi is reference to someone who is, I guess, a simpleton, as it says here. A fool. Okay, even more than I thought. A Peti is a fool. Ya'amin l'chol davar. He will believe anything. Fools are gullible. You tell them something, and this, you might be, you know, we can have a whole, you know, diatribe and rant about this one also. The conspiracy theorists of our world on social media, how many people will read, you know, one of the strangest resurgences in our world is the resurgence of the flat earthers. The fact that in 2021, there are people that believe that the earth is flat because of some crazy YouTube videos that only give very weird arguments is one of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. And sometimes I'll watch the flat earther videos just to figure out how crazy people are. You know, they have conferences and there are real celebrities that believe. We have a literal documented photographs, real videos of the world being round from outer space. And nonetheless, people believe that the earth is flat somehow. So either way, that's what peti yamin l'chol davar, a fool who doesn't have discerning intellect will believe anything. Will believe anything. Va'arum yavin l'ashiro, but someone who is cunning or has cleverness. Someone who's clever will understand things correctly, right? Because they're the ones that are going to hopefully compare and contrast data points. They're going to look at evidence. They're going to look at different things to hopefully figure out what's true and what's not true. As opposed to the pasi, the fool who is so gullible will believe anything. And obviously, we can take this into modern, more immediate concerns of the vaccine. I know what Steve's thinking and other things like that, but we won't go there. But obviously, you can apply this to other things. The Peti is going to believe anything. They can believe anything. The Ralbag points out, this is, our last introduction for the Sefer tonight. The Ralbag is right at the top, often at the bottom, and this time it's at the bottom and the top, right? You'll find it here at the bottom, the Ralbag, also at the top here. So he says, Peti yamin l'chol davar, hinei ha'isha, peti yamin l'chol davar, ulezeh yitzpateh. They'll be seduced or convinced. L'chol davar mizulas ha'isponenus. Right? They'll be convinced of everything except for critical thinking. Im hu ra'oi la'asos kein. Im lo. Whether it's appropriate to do it or not, they'll believe it. Umizulas ha'isponenus b'drach ma'ru'yim la'agia al-tachlis ha'hu v'ivlam v'ulam. Sorry. Right, without the proper critical thinking of what's required to get to that conclusion. Ve'ulam, however, hachacham yavin la'ashuro imhurao imlo ube'eze derech yagia ilav. Right, they'll know whether that thing is appropriate and how it is that you can best get to it if it is. So obviously, something to take to heart. Always be a little wary of anything you read online, anything you read in the papers, and especially anything you hear as hearsay from someone else's third cousin's previous doctor's dog's former owner, whatever it might be. Right? Always have to be careful where you get things from, and make sure that you source it, and make sure you hear all the sides of the story, as opposed to just assuming based on one YouTube video that this is a hoax or that's a conspiracy or whatever. Not going to get into too many more political. I've gone to too political tonight already. So we'll leave it at that. Mirat Hashem, we'll pick up next week with Pasuk Tes Zayin. Everyone should have a good night. If you want this book, you see how I'm going to use it. We're going to quote from the book. We're going to read from the book. So if you want one of these, I will drop one off free of cost. And we can all be on the same page. Otherwise, we'll continue like this. Just let me know. Everyone should have a good night. Thanks for joining in.
Thank you.
I want
Steve, you want one?
Yeah, I'd like one.
Okay, great.